You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Rainer Judd. Rainer, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your filmmaking. You're a filmmaker, and I'm fascinated with what you're working on now. What is the current project that you're working on, or you could start with any way you want relating to your film, studio practice, but I'm interested in your filmmaking.
Well, I've been working on a feature film for quite a while now in script form with a really incredible woman story editor named Lana Griffin out of Seattle. And I actually went to film school long, long ago and made a bunch of shorts and also made documentary material and was very involved with the Judd Foundation's Oral History Project, but finally got around to putting a narrative, fictionalized, autobiographical film together. So it's like a very big project, and it takes a long time, but I'm nearing the end of the script process. And I was just thinking about how that work relates with, I do small projects with some companies. Like, I just did a project, I work with a team of ladies, and we just did a project with Rag and Bone, and then another project I did with Ace Hotel with drawings in London. But those small projects kind of keep me going in the large project. They allow me to get something completed and out there while working on this film, which, as anybody who's done a big project knows, it takes a certain endurance to, do something that takes a long time that you don't share with the world for quite a while.
Well, right, but beyond that also, a film that's autobiographical and fictionalized, it's kind of like having, I don't know if a retrospective or a survey, but in an even deeper way, this is about your life and cumulative aspects of your life, I would imagine. Or what is the approach to it? Because it would seem that it's something that is, depending on how autobiographical it is, in a way sums up everything that you've been doing or have been doing. Is that the case?
I think its main character is a 7-year-old girl, and it's a way for me to share pretty incredible things that I learned as a kid that I probably took for granted for a long time. The nice thing about getting older is that, or the lots of nice things about getting older, as well as some not so nice. Nice thing about getting older is that you get perspective on your gifts that you've been given. And I think it was I'm reading this incredible Pablo Casals book, The Art of Interpretation. And I think it was in the beginning, the writer, David Blum, was encouraged by Anthony Hopkins to write this book, and he was saying that, like, how could you have all this incredible information about this person and not share it, insight into somebody? And I feel in a way that there is, I think he was calling it, like, intellectual imperative, or I can't remember the term he used, but I feel inspired to share things I've learned and to put it in pretty poetic, beautiful story form. So that's one of the things that drives me with that project. Plus, I'm just...
But are these things that you've learned? I mean, I feel in a way I could guess at them, but it's about a world of aesthetics, isn't it? It's about growing up in a world where you are surrounded by not only aesthetic objects, but a way of viewing the world. Is that primarily what you're talking about?
I would say a way of viewing the world, but also the interrelatedness between nature and art and even being an outspoken citizen, how all those things really make a human whole. We all have different ways of becoming who we are that you and I were talking about earlier. And I love the quote that I can't remember word for word by Vonnegut about it's all about becoming who you are. And I feel like if you don't give up on that and just throw it in the trash, if you really grow that, you start to link different aspects of life together, from everything from like the inner core spiritual things to art to how you feel about people who run countries, what is happening with the environment, to how you live your everyday life and what brings you pleasure and how to follow your instincts about, yeah, being on the planet and what you do. This sounds kind of far out there, but I feel like those things are all linked, and the more we can dialogue about them and make connections, the more we will evolve as humans.
I believe that. I buy that. So, but this film is from the point of view of a 7-year-old, right? Those all sound like kind of very mature observations and kind of analysis.
Well, that's the beauty of it, that you get to put it in very simple terms through a little girl's eyes. That's why I think...
So this is what the little girl is learning at that time? It's kind of how she's absorbing and interpreting what's happening?
Yeah. I would tell you about a scene, but I think that would give it away. But yeah, there are really simple ways to learn these things, I think, as a kid. And I think kids have a knack for being open to, for one, to nature, a kind of inherent curiosity about it that maybe we lose a little bit in the busyness as adults, but also a drive to become themselves. And I was definitely in an environment where I could have folded under the nearby strong identity. but you have the choice to become inspired and be kind of in a role of maybe not an apprentice, but in some ways apprentice, but to take in and be inspired by big people around you. There's so many really inspiring people in my life, rather than just see them as big and ominous. I really grilled all of them about how to become me. If that makes any sense.
That does make sense. And I'm kind of, thinking that it's, that obviously the figures you're talking about, right, are your mother, your father, how you grew up, many people do absorb the kind of things you're talking about from parents, even parents who are great artists or aesthetics somehow, but not everyone does. Not everyone's even kind of wonderful artistic parents are necessarily there for their children, I mean, the experience that you're talking about as a 7-year-old also sounds kind of rare and magical, almost,
I think probably most parents, I can only speak for the ones that I know, but I think there's always something lacking in parenting, right? There's no way
right.
A parent can be everything to a kid. It's a bit of a crapshoot, but what's amazing is what the parent does give for the kid to be able to take that and run with it, rather than kind of swim around in the lack that they notice. So if you're a fairly whole person, you're going to piece together what you need to grow from different people. So you're raised by a community that allows you to really appreciate your parents for what they are and what they can give you.
Right. So let's move back a little bit then in kind of concrete terms. So you're 7 years old. growing up? What's happening? What kind of questions are you asking? If this isn't a spoiler for the film, I'm kind of interested in now tracing your life from then till now. What were you asking? What did you, was there something you wanted to be or a direction you were moving in even then at seven? Can you give us a snapshot of that?
Well, a lot of my film was created about a time in my childhood I didn't remember very well. So it was going back and piecing together. It is a fictionalized character because I pieced together and also compressed whole eras of time and used my life trajectory and other characters' whole life trajectories. But going through, I don't know if I want to give you plot lines, but basically...
Okay, don't, but it could be just, you don't have to give me plot lines, but rather than even talking about the film, more about what you do remember. We could start at a later date from, you know, what you were going through or remember now of the memories of seven, but maybe a little bit older. What are the first memories that come to you now of kind of collecting some of the aesthetic impressions that you were talking about?
Well, I think I've always been curious as to why we're on the planet. And my dad was a very philosophical guy and was really great at engaging in dialogue on a daily basis. And I didn't know that. Well, once I started bringing my friends over, then I started realizing they would say, wow, your dad talks to me like I'm intelligent, like I'm an adult. And I think that kind of place in dialogue to wonder about the cosmos, why we're here, why this thing tastes like that and that thing tastes like that, and why in language this word sounds like this and that word sounds like that. All those conversations allowed a kind of natural muscle for curiosity and exploration. And that relationship, I think I'm interested in expressing that dialogue between a kid and a parent.
And that's so important, you know, that's so, I mean, to stay with that for a minute, you know, the idea of a dialogue that's engaging and important to both parties is something that I think is probably lacking in most parenting, or, you know, maybe that's too general to say, but, you know, I kind of, my parents weren't like that, but I've met people who were, as I grew up, kind of engaged and could sort of engage, it seems, anyone on a conversation that would bring something out of them, that would allow them to think, probably like your friends were saying, being treated as someone who's intelligent and has something worth saying. I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just going to add that I think anybody at any age, if you speak to them with respect for who they are and what they think, especially if they don't get that very much, it calls on a certain part of them. You must find this in interviews. I find that people I've known for a long time, that then when I interview them, they're being called to share a story or something of themselves, and they rise to the occasion. And then I think great dialogue is like that, like in just a plain old conversation. If you give somebody respect and you believe they have a mind there, you could be talking about, I don't know, how black charcoal is. But it will be interesting because you're giving them the respect of their mind and being and, you know, spirit.
Right. So you're working on this film. This continues to evolve. What else is happening? I know you were talking about the other side projects that are contributing to your artistic activity, but also to the film. What kind of things like that are happening now?
Well, I just started making some prints with a printmaker in Marfa, Texas named Robert Arbor, and that's really, really fun. I've never done lithography, and I started drawing pretty late compared to most people because maybe because I was busy with film, and also my brother is such an amazing drawer that I never really took that, developed it or took it seriously until I just needed to draw. And then the more I drew, the more I realized, oh, well, this is the way I draw. And I find that really gratifying, dealing with materials, and I'm really interested in language and imagery. So it, I mean, there's my dad's side, which is fine art and aesthetic and crafts and materials, but I also come from a line of poets on my mom's side. So I need to, I've always needed to find a place for this lyrical output that I have. And the drawing allows me to do that with words.
So there were poets on your mom's side?
Yeah. One of my grandma is 92, and she's still writing poetry. And then
wow.
I have an aunt who is a great poet named Annie Finch. And when I was 18, actually, I was shown these journals of my great aunt Jessie, who had kept journals her whole time. And I realized why I'm compelled to keep journals is because it's actually something that generations of ladies in my family have done. So journals are a big part of my process, I would say.
Because you've been taking journals since you have been very young, right?
Yeah, since I was 11. That was something my dad didn't do, but I gave him so many blank books, but he wasn't a journaler. But he was very respectful of somebody who could journal.
So your printmaking, your writing, and what else happens in your
involved,
routine?
Very involved with the Judd Foundation. My brother and I lead it with our board, and we have this great staff in New York and Texas. And we're just, it's kind of amazing to me the trajectory of that, because it's been a long journey. My brother and I became executors when I was 23 and he was 25. And it seemed to be this big, big weight and work for the longest time from a financial point of view especially. But we really held out, and now we have an endowment and a staff, and we get to do amazing things. Like, we get to have crazy ideas and do them. So that's something that's been really rewarding, not only because it's a relationship with my brother, which is very special, but it's, I think, very rewarding to have an activity that's outside of my work, that it's like I get to continue to learn about my dad's ideas and then find ways in the real world to engage with other people about them. And we're particularly interested in not being a stodgy, just library or museum or institution. We're interested always in doing things differently from a design perspective, from a curatorial perspective, while we preserve these installed spaces we have. We have 16 buildings in West Texas and this 5-story cast iron building in Soho where our dad's art is installed along with art of other artists. And it's just a very rewarding activity. I mean, every once in a while, you'll be going over a budget and that won't be so fun. But for the most part, it's a dynamic, collaborative experience.
And you said the wonderful thing about, the endowment and the board and how it's funded is that you can do some crazy things sometimes. What would be one of those crazy things that's happened at the foundation?
Well, it seemed actually kind of crazy to restore Spring Street. I think for quite a while it seemed like a crazy thing to people, even some of our board members. We were told that, I mean, even from an architectural point of view, that that's ridiculous. You can't have a place that holds art that's built in the 1890s. This is an old building. And not only that, how can you restore it, make it open to the public, and still retain its kind of great shoddy quality? You know, like
right.
Soho loft building. But I think it's even exciting. Like, I don't know when you're going to play this, but maybe this idea is okay, not being so secret. But we're even talking about taking the first floor and rebuilding some of the library shelves that are in Texas and really opening up the first floor for people to come in and sit around and read books and sit on Judd furniture and, yeah, maybe buy books too. And it just seems amazingly fun that we can have this idea about opening up a whole ground floor in Soho. You know, all the time, like, Cartier is asking to rent it, and we say no, and instead we're going to open it up for people to read books in. That it just makes me happy because it feels like it's continuing to do things in the spirit that I was raised in, that not everything is about commerce.
Right, and that, because that is a wonderful and crazy idea in the context, right, of Cartier or someone like that wanting to rent or,
yeah,
or work.
Like, we just want to do things differently, and we want to keep that little corner of Soho in the spirit of what makes us happy, and share it with other people there.
And how do you work with other artists? I know this. I mean, maybe tell us a little bit about, in a curatorial sense, how Marfa works.
You know, we don't.
And the Foundation, or is there? Yeah.
We don't spend a lot of time, we don't run an artist in residency program. Chinati Foundation does, and Ballroom Marfa does a lot of work with contemporary artists. So we're not pursuing that as a program. However, we get requests from artists to do things, but we do have this space on the ground floor that we can show art of artists that were relevant to our dad. Or, for example, we did for the launch of the library website a few years back, we did a special edition of a bookmark with Lawrence Weiner. Every once in a while, we'll do something special with an artist. But we've got a lot of thoughts and ideas internally, so we don't do a ton of outreach to artists. In the long run, it would be nice if the ranch houses that we have were more available, not just to artists, but to scientists or writers or just anybody that we thought was really interesting.
Is that a vision for the future of it, to have more people like that there? The different mediums?
Is it a vision for the future to have people out to the ranches?
Yeah, is it a vision for the future to have people out to the ranches and, you know, who work in different mediums, who are, you know, maybe more emerging artists as well as mid-career? Is that something you're thinking about?
I think for us, we don't even think in art world terms about categorizing artists that way. They're just, you know, we just call them artists, astronomers, and writers, and cool people. We don't really deal with, how do I explain that? I don't know that it's that important of a point to make, but we don't have this relationship with the art world as such, where...
I mean, the reason I picked up on that, or I think the reason I mentioned emerging artists or mid-career is when I hear names like Lawrence Weiner or Klaus Oldenburg and essentially peers or close to it of your father's, that seems like a kind of subset of the art world, as opposed to I don't know, people who are unknown perhaps, or little known, and have not made as much of an impression on the art world as certainly some of the work that's in the Judd Foundation and elsewhere.
In terms of having artists in residency, I think we're pretty open. I don't think it matters whether somebody is known or not. Maybe once we got into that program, there would be some sort of, curatorial mandate that somebody proposes, or administrative or bureaucratic process that then would try to put emerging artists at a disadvantage. But I think from where my brother and I come from, if somebody wants to sit and think and draw or write or look at the stars, that's what's important, that the place in their trajectory that they're in is not the issue.
Right, where they are in their career is not the issue. It's how they're approaching it. And so from a curatorial perspective, are you and your brother primarily in charge of the curatorial vision of Martha and the foundation?
Well, we oversee our director of operations and our director of finance, and then our director of operations is overseeing the maintenance. But it's all pretty simple because we take care of the spaces and we have a visitor program where people just make appointments to visit, so it's not like a curatorial job at the moment, but just taking care of the spaces and making sure everybody gets to get through is what we've been doing a lot of, along with Catalog Resume and a lot of conservation work.
And fundraising, I would imagine fundraising is a big part of that whole job, because that's also what's kind of the miracle, is the funding of you know, Spring Street, because it's really somewhat improbable, as the board of directors were saying, to have an endowment for all of this and run all of this, isn't
it?
Yeah,
and I don't think we're even done with our financial challenges, but it is absolutely a miracle that all of it is working. I mean, I don't take it for granted. I mean, I try not to take it for granted, because it's, in the scope of things in the world, what gets money and what doesn't get money, this is just not one of those things that normally would get money. Having art in spaces that doesn't, you know, the art doesn't move, it's not going anywhere, and we're just letting people come in and spend time with it. Our goal is to find different ways for people to come and spend time with it rather than just walking through.
Right.
But we're not necessarily an organization. The Warhol Foundation, for example, is set up completely differently, where their goal is to give money away to artists, which is so admirable and powerful what they do. But our foundation was set up to kind of sit still and let people in and call them to it. We're kind of geographically grounded.
Right. I mean, it's not unlike a lot of the... I think that model happens a little more in Europe, doesn't it? There's museums that are created or built around the work of one artist. You know, the Leger Museum, Matisse. You know, there seem to be lots of those, and that's been going on for decades before there was the kind of booming art world or anything. And it's a wonderful way to look at an artist's work, to see it, you know, where it was meant to be, whether it was in a home or just a lot of it collected together that's not moving.
Yeah. So I think for us it's a combination of making that studio world open to the public, but also finding ways to engage with the world that keep it alive and relevant, and find ways to keep our dad's spirit alive rather than just, you know, getting to see the objects and not know what they are, what he was thinking, to actually, you know, read his writings or see some quotes and footage.
So let's talk about that briefly and in closing, because that seems very powerful. What does it really mean to keep your dad's spirit alive? Because that seems very powerful to me. I mean, of course, we think of that through his artwork, but you're thinking of it in a richer sense, I imagine.
Well, on one hand, I guess I would preface by saying, on one hand, you know, you let a person go. Once they're dead, you let them go. So I do want to agree with that, but I think it just in the way you can connect with the spirit of somebody when you read their book 300 years later, that a spirit that, pretty much going back to what we started the conversation with, that is fueled by so many things in life, by a spirit that's fueled by nature, by speaking up for your street corner, by speaking out against war, by fighting for environmental, I'd say wildlife preservation, dealing with, I mean, showing somebody, this might sound trite, but showing somebody some beautiful bowls that might blow their mind can actually change a day, because you realize that the things that you live with affect your everyday. So I think the complexity of life and the philosophy of life is something that's in his spirit that we can benefit from. I mean, I just road tripped across from Texas to New York, and I forget, in New York we're so coddled by food and aesthetics, but I forget there's a lot of cultural deprivation in our country, and there's a lot of, I don't even know a word beyond a lot. There's a ton of bad architecture that we're surrounded by, and to not consider that a cultural imperative, to not consider, I don't think we should give up on architecture mattering is, I don't even know if mattering is a word, like architecture matters, what things look like matter, urban planning matters. I think that's part of my dad's spirit, that all these things are vital and important, and you should make it better, you should ask for it to be better, don't give up.
Yes, I agree. And so how should listeners of this, or artists and different people, how should they interact with it? Foundation or Marfa? I know some of it's by appointment. How can people see the foundation, or as well as visit Marfa?
So they can absolutely visit by going to the website jedfoundation.org. They can visit either, there's a constant visiting schedule in both Marfa and Spring Street, and then there's a whole patron program for those that want to get more involved, as well as there's this great program at Spring Street where if you're a New York artist, you get to visit for free. So depending on who you are and how you want to engage with the foundation, you can also just, you know, send us an email and say hello, or what you feel, you know, if somebody has an idea of how they want to be involved in the foundation, they can just reach out as well.
And Marfa?
Sorry?
And then in Marfa, in terms of visiting or people going down there, how should they do that? Or is it,
it's the same website. It's judfoundation.org. And then in Marfa, I'm pretty sure the schedule is Tuesday through Saturday. There are both custom visits and then regularly scheduled visits. So depending on what somebody's schedule and financial ability are, there's different tours or visits.
Okay, and lastly, to end it up on a question that is probably unanswerable, you talked a little bit about at the beginning about questioning things and kind of why are we here on this planet and what that may lead to. What does that mean to you? Why are we here on this planet, Raina?
I'd say maybe three answers. We're here to become the most creative, evolved beings that we can be. We're here to share with each other, but also take care of this planet. And I guess that would be contribute to human evolution so that humans don't destroy the planet. Does that sound really...
that sounds good.
That's actually what I believe in. Yeah, I think we're here to leave it better than when we arrived.
Well, Raina, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to seeing your film. Do you have any idea when that might be out or when we can look for it?
Like a couple of years, generally. It takes like a year and a half, 2 years.
And is there a title for it?
You know, I'm just really debating that right now, so I won't say, but I'll keep you in touch with what's going on.
Okay.
I'll
like that.
In the loop.
Raina, thanks so much. I really appreciate
you. Yeah, thank
you,
Brainerd. Have a great time with this program and also with making art.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.